If you weren't here last week, which is a good number of you, we're doing a two-part series on the subject and the idea of life after death, and what the Bible speaks to that issue. At the end of last year, we had a few funerals in here, and those funerals brought forth a lot of questions from people on this subject. So a lot of our congregation, a lot of people regularly attend, we're asking all sorts of questions. Well, what does the Bible say about this? Or what did Jesus say about this? So both last week and this week, we're trying to address some of those questions. So if you're just jumping in with us this week, you're kind of like, it's like kind of coming into a play right after intermission. You sort of a little bit missed the first half. But if for any reason this talk intrigues you, all our talks are online with podcasts and everything else. So if you're curious what we said last week, you can catch the first bit. I want to begin by reading out some famous last words. I don't know if you've ever read any articles or gone online or heard sometimes, you know, what are people's last words? What did Napoleon say or so-and-so say right before they died? I went online and looked around and collected a few that I thought might be interesting. Elvis Presley, his last words before he died were, "I'm going to the bathroom to read." Raphael, before he moved to America and became a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, was an Italian artist, a painter, who died at the age of 37, and his last word was just happy. He said the word happy, and then he died. Frank Sinatra, he looked over at someone and said, "I think I'm losing it." And he died. Marie Antoinette, before she was guillotined in the French Revolution, said, "Pardonnez-moi, monsieur." Very insulted that she was being treated so poorly. For you perfectionists out there, I thought this one is for you. Leonardo da Vinci, his last words were, "I have offended God and mankind because my work did not reach the quality it should have." So, there you go. Buddha, Gautama Buddha, 600 BC, his last words to his disciples before he died was, "Work hard to gain your own salvation." Work hard to gain your own salvation. And this is my personal favorite, although I have to say before I read it, there's some debate about this one. There's argument whether this is urban legend or whether this really was his last words. This is Humphrey Bogart from, you may know the 1940s film Casablanca. Supposedly, maybe, his last words were reported to be, "I should never have switched from scotch to martinis." I thought that was brilliant. There's a few romantic sweet ones here. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle of Sherlock Holmes fame looked over at his wife and simply said, "You are wonderful," and then he died. Ernest Hemingway said to his wife Mary, his last words were to his wife Mary and said, "Good night, my kitten." Now it's a little less romantic, you realize he went and committed suicide then. But those were his last words nonetheless. Similarly, T.S. Eliot simply said his wife's name, Valerie. Groucho Marx, his last words were, "This is no way to live." Abraham Lincoln. So for those of you unfamiliar with the American president, Abraham Lincoln, he's the one who led America through the Civil War and freed the slaves in the middle of the 19th century. His last words, he was assassinated in a play. He was there in the theater watching a play and sat next to his wife. But right before he was shot, he leaned over to his wife and he said, the Civil War had only been over 5 days and they had been in the middle of the discussion about what would they do with the rest of their lives now that they had successfully led America through the Civil War. It's like, what do you do after something like that, you know? But he leaned over to his wife and said, "We will visit the Holy Land and see those places hallowed by the footsteps of the Savior. There is no city on earth I so much desire to see as Jerusalem." And a few seconds later, he was shot in the back of the head. Vladimir Lenin of the Russian Revolution, his last words were, "Good dog." Actually, that's not entirely true. His last words were, "Vot sobaka," which means good dog. He said it in Russian, of course, but he said it to his dog who was bringing him a dead bird. The actress Joan Crawford was very ill in her house and receiving medical attention. And her housekeeper came in and saw Joan in a lot of pain and in such bad condition. And this housekeeper just silently, you know, kind of made the cross and started praying for Joan. And Joan noticed this, that her housekeeper was praying for, and she kind of mustered up some energy to lean up in bed and said, "Damn it, don't you dare ask God to help me." And she fell down dead. Emily Dickinson, one of my favorite poets, said, "I must go in. The fog is rising." And she died. And lastly, and kind of sadly, was Sir Winston Churchill, where he simply said, "I'm bored with it all." And then he died. We read all those to create a little bit of context. We're interested in people's last words because we often think it maybe will sum up something about their life. It'll be maybe a grand finale, some sort of expression about what their life has meant, or even some anticipation of where they might be going once they die. So final words interest us, and it's no less with the life of Jesus. Now, Jesus, as he was dying, as probably many of you know, he died on a cross, and that whole process took 6 hours, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And it was 6 hours of torture. It was a slow death, and yet, as crucifixions go, 6 hours wasn't particularly a long time. Sometimes they could take all the way up to 24 hours for the victim to die. But on the cross, he had seven last words. He uttered seven phrases from the cross, and today we're going to look at the very last of those seven. It's just one verse here. And this was the last thing Jesus said. Luke, in his gospel, records it. And Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I entrust my spirit." And then Luke adds, "And saying this, he breathed his last." This short little phrase, and this is the only real verse, we're just going to talk on this today. These last words encapsulate so much of Jesus's life, both the way he had lived and what he anticipated would happen to him when he died. And this little phrase, it not only does it sum up so much of Jesus's past to that point, as well as his future, it also answers a lot of the questions that we received as a congregation over the last couple months leading up to a number of the funerals we had. There we go. Well, I normally have a clicker, but I've lost it, so I have to snap at poor William here. One of the questions we received, I'm going to look at a few of these words. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. I'm going to look at that. First of all, I'm going to look at that last word, spirit. Jesus said, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." And one of the questions we received from a number of people, and it was asked in slightly different ways, is, do we have a spirit separate from our bodies that go to heaven? A lot of people wanted to know, a lot of Christians particularly wanted to know is, well, what did Jesus say about exactly what happens to you when you die? Because we understand there's this idea of resurrection and the body comes out, but doesn't the spirit float to heaven? Or how does that all work? Okay, well, first of all, you are correct if you think Christianity places, and Jesus in particular, placed a lot of emphasis on this idea of resurrection. That's very central to the gospel. However, this came at a time where everybody knew that resurrections were impossible, much like today. However, for very different reasons. In the Greco-Roman world at the time, there was no thought of a resurrection. Plato was sort of the main philosopher that set a lot of the ideas for the spirit and the body, and the thought was that your body, your physical body, wasn't very important. It was kind of dirty. The material world wasn't that great. And at death, hopefully, your spirit would ascend to the pure world of the spirit. And that Western idea has been in Western thought really ever since the time of Plato. And a lot of times we as Christians can kind of import that into our idea to heaven. I die, and then my spirit somehow floats off, and I'm on a cloud with fat, chubby babies and nappies and playing harps and all this sort of thing. But that's not primarily what the New Testament particularly talks about. It talks about that one day there's going to be this resurrection. And this was very common in Jewish thought. What was different about Christianity was that there was absolutely nothing in Jewish thought of a physical resurrection happening in the middle of history. Some Jews believed there'd be a resurrection at the end of time. Some did, some didn't. But some of the Jews believed at the very end of human history, there'd be this general resurrection and there'd be a judgment. Each person would answer to God according to their deeds. Some Jews believed that, some didn't. But there was nothing in their thought process, nothing in their philosophy that thought right in the middle of history that God would raise somebody up. And this is why at Jesus' resurrection, none of his disciples believe it's real at first. They're after Jesus dies, they're off hiding. They're not anticipating him to come back at all. And so when he comes back, it's not only a shock to his enemies and to his foes, but it's a shock to his followers as well, because it was completely off the radar intellectually. His resurrection happened in a world where no one believed in resurrections. Once again, a lot like ours, only for slightly different reasons. Jesus says this, but so if the emphasis is so much on resurrection, what's this whole thing about into your hands I commit my spirit? Jesus didn't say into your hands I commit my body. What did he mean? Well, we get these hints in the New Testament, and they're not talked about a lot. But the idea is that when we die, and if you're a child of God, while you wait somehow until the end of history, when there is this resurrection, there is a sense in which you're in the presence of God. Now, if you're here and you're visiting with us and you're not a Christian or you're not a theist or you don't believe there's any sort of life after death and you think this is just some odd metaphysical discussion that has nothing to do with you, I just want to challenge you to see how practical this is in defining what it means to be human. The term human rights comes from the Middle Ages and was originally a legal term defined by papal lawyers defining that the poor had a right to be fed. And they started using this term human rights, and our modern concept of human rights kind of developed from this, from these papal lawyers trying to create the laws that would ensure that the poor got fed. The Greco-Roman world that existed previous to Christ had no concept of human rights. You were treated according to your place in the social hierarchy. The idea that there was an egalitarian human rights that everyone deserved to be treated, regardless if you're rich or poor, powerful or weak, that arose many centuries later. But I want you to think, well, what is it that makes us human? You might not believe in God. You might not believe in the afterlife. But you probably believe in human rights. But I want to challenge you, why do you believe in them? What is it that makes us human? You might think, well, it's physical. You know, human beings have value, dignity, and worth because of our physical bodies. And we are, look at our bodies. We are human, and therefore, if you see another human as a human body like you, you should treat them with dignity and respect and worth. That pushes. What if something happens to that body? What if you're an amputee? What if you're in an accident? What if you lose your arms or your legs? And you've lost a lot of your body. Are you less human? Are you less human if you lose part of your physical body? Is it just the body that defines you? If you've lost a third of your body in a tragic accident, do you lose a third of your human rights? Or are you still fully human? Well, no, okay, it's not our physical body, but it's our brains. It's our mental powers. The fact we think differently from the animals that, you know, well, we deserve to be treated better than the animals because, you know, we can reflect and we can make art and, you know, we can do philosophy and, you know, sit around and ask abstract questions about things like life after death. Okay, well, what if you lose that? What if you're mentally incapacitated? You have a brain tumor that needs to be removed and the surgery doesn't go right and you not only lose a hunk of your brain, but you lose those mental powers. Or have you lost part of your, are you no longer entitled to be respected with dignity and worth as a human? Is it just the brain? Can the brain alone really account for human consciousness? Is it just the synapse? Is it just the physical synapse in the brain that causes you to be conscious that you're in this room right now, whether you're enjoying this or not? Is it just that, or do you have something of a spirit that transcends just the brain, that gives you worth. And even if you were to lose some of those mental powers due to dementia or Alzheimer's or a whole host of different things, that you should be treated. Are you part spirit? What is it that makes us human different from just an animal? It's a hard question. It's not an easy question. It's a big discussion, not just for Christians, but for everyone in our society. It touches on questions ranging from euthanasia to abortion of people who, you know, are pregnant, particularly with, if you know your baby has Down syndrome, all sorts of things. It touches on a whole host of ethical issues. And Jesus, even though the emphasis in Christianity is this idea of the resurrection, there is this idea that there is something distinct from the body called the spirit. Paul says it this way in the New Testament elsewhere. He says, physical exercise is a little bit useful. However, godliness is profitable not only for this life and the life to come. That means that this year, though some of you probably at the new year made some goals, some of which might affect your health and your body, you know, I'm going to work out more, exercise more, swim more, go to the gym more, diet more, try keto, intermittent fasting, whatever you're going to try. You know, you do it for a couple weeks and you give up and, you know, you're frustrated with yourself. The Bible says those things can be good and have some value, but don't place too much importance on those. Because you can diet and exercise and work out, and you might add a few extra years to your life, but in the end, you're just going to die anyway. You know, I kind of wonder if, you know, talking about last words, you know, I wanted to know if anyone's last words were, shoot, I was hoping that diet would work better than it did. Or, you know, I should have eaten my broccoli or something like this. On one hand, don't put too much stock, but also don't get too frustrated. If your body doesn't always look or do all the things you want it to do, if you're not able to lose that weight you really want to lose, if you wish there's some things different about your body than are, and sometimes that frustrates you, the Bible would say, guys, that's not where your worth ultimately comes from. Maybe you'd like to be taller, but you're never going to be taller. Maybe you'd like to change this about your physical body, but hey, that's just not going to change because you don't have enough money for that much cosmetic surgery, you know. And so that's just not going to change. God says, listen, that's really not the most important thing. He loves you because he loves you. And there are things much more important to who you are and to your humanity than just your body, though your body is also very important as well. So Jesus says this. He says, you know, into your hands I commit my spirit. The spirit and the body go together like hand and glove. Both are very important. And yet there's something about you that cannot be reduced to this. We don't embrace physical reductionism. There's something more to you than just atoms and matter. There's something very unique in the image of God. We go on. Back to Jesus says, cut out, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Second word I want to focus on just a minute is this word Father. Now, if you're at all familiar with Christian teaching or who Jesus was or his life, Jesus was very unique. He was unlike any other rabbi in the day in that he went around referring to God as his Father. Nobody else did that. No other great religious teacher did that. He was unique. Whenever he prayed, he'd say, Father, or praise. He saw himself as God's son, and he looked to God and said, you are my Father. And there's this just affection and love that he had for the God of Israel. And every time he talked to God, he referred to him as Father. And in fact, Jesus' first phrase on the cross when Jesus is being crucified and the nails are being driven into his hands, he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And he prays for those people who are torturing him and killing him, and he prays for their forgiveness. Father, forgive them. And yet, after that first phrase, once he is put up on the cross, the Bible records that the sky grew dark, and it was like dark clouds. Though it was the middle of the day, dark clouds come and just kind of cover Jerusalem. And it became dark, and during that time, it was the only time in Jesus' life where he did not speak to God as Father. Instead, Scripture records that he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? See, Christian teaching is that on the cross, something very unusual happened to Jesus. And to kind of understand why that word is significant, You got to understand the whole of the teaching that God was in and of himself was filled with light and love and, you know, life, light and life. And he created this world to be filled with light and life and love. But we turned away from all that and brought in darkness and we brought in death and we brought in disconnection. But God, because of who he was, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, he saw us in a pit and he loved us. And he came down to get involved and to help us. He said, your pain's going to become my pain. Your mess is going to become my mess. And ultimately then Jesus on the cross, he, though he was light and life and love, he takes on the opposite of those things. Though he was love, he took on hatred. He took on disconnection. Though he was light, he took on darkness. Though he was life, he took on death. And all of my sin and your sin and all of that just got piled on Jesus and all that darkness, and he just went plunged down into the deepest hell. He took that on himself. And there was this disconnection somehow. Though he had no guilt in of himself, he assumed our guilt in our place. And this brought up another big question. In fact, last week after I was done the first one, we talked a little bit about heaven this week, or last week rather. Go ahead to the next one. Last week I talked about heaven, and I like to talk about heaven. That's great. It's very easy. It suits well with my personality. I usually read from Tolkien and The Hobbit and C.S. Lewis and also my favorite books to try to just stir the imagination of what that place might be like. But I stepped down afterwards, and one of the ladies who is kind of new here said, "You talked a lot about heaven." She said, "But what about hell?" I said, "I don't like to talk about that." And she goes, "Yeah, but didn't Jesus talk about it?" And I said, "Yes. So if we don't talk about it, we're not really a Christian church, are we?" And she's just sharp, man. She just dug into me. And I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, it is coming, you know." I said, "Don't worry. As Christians, we lack integrity if we say we follow Jesus and never bring up the subject, simply because Jesus talked about it a lot. And if all we do is talk about heaven and never hell, we become like this poor salesman that just talks about what's really great about the car and not about sort of the ugly things that, you know, people don't want to hear about." But Jesus talked a lot about this. And why this is so important, one of the reasons it's so important to do this, to address this question, is because ultimately we believe that this is what Jesus took on himself for you and me. Can we flip to the next one, William? Jesus talked a lot. Here's just one example. I couldn't go through all the examples, but Jesus would often talk about hell, and every time he talked about it, he used metaphor. Sometimes he would talk about fire, or sometimes he'd talk about chains, or sometimes talk about darkness. And he'd talk in these parables that, for example, in Matthew 22:13, Jesus is telling a story, and he says, "Then the king told the attendants, 'Tie him up hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth.'" And all his references to hell are very abstract and very vague, very sort of poetical. We don't entirely understand fully what he's talking about. Other than this, one, if you want to, part of being made in the image of God, part of being made as moral creatures with real choices and real freedom is this: if you really want to screw yourself up in a cosmic way, it's possible. Like, that's how radical the power of human choice actually is. That God creates life and love, light, and invites us to that. But if we want to go in an opposite direction and towards disconnection, towards darkness, you know, we're able to. We're free to. The way Jesus talked about hell, it was very particular, though. You know, we live in a day and age where you can be shamed just because of what you believe. Now, you may notice, like many of you probably have certain opinions on politics or social issues or whatever, and sometimes you're scared to share them in public or on social media or anything like that because, oh goodness, you would be a bit scolded. You know, you'd be scolded. How dare you believe that? You know, now it's one thing, great, people have different opinions. It's wonderful when you can sit down with someone with a different opinion. Maybe they're of a different political party or a different different ideas on certain social issues, and you can sit down and talk about it in a very helpful way. But we live in a day and age where that's increasingly hard to do, where you kind of get scolded just for believing those things. Not challenge. It's right to challenge people in their beliefs, but we live in a day where people get scolded. And Christians, I think particularly, if you're here and you're a Christian, you probably, I'm guessing, you're very reluctant to ever bring up this subject. Primarily because if you think, well, I think when you die, there's not just a heaven, there might be a hell too. It's like, how dare you believe that? You know, how primitive of you. And yet, if we're going to have integrity, we can't say we follow Jesus, but we're not willing to address this issue. Christians have really had difficulty understanding, though, what Jesus means by it. Sometimes in the West, with Catholics and Protestants, we often kind of think of it as a place we go to. We go to this place of either regret or darkness, or somehow we choose to go here, and we think of it as a place. Eastern Orthodox Christians, they tend to think of it less as a place and more of a state of being. In Eastern Orthodox, in the Russian and Greek Orthodox churches, they often just see Jesus coming back someday and filling the earth with his glory. And whether you're in heaven or hell or not, just depends on your relationship with him. And people are walking around on earth next to each other, but they're experiencing life very differently. It's like God's glory is this great golden light of joy and peace to the people who love him. But to the people who do not, they're just grumbling about how terrible it is. You get a little bit of this in C.S. Lewis's book, The Last Battle. If you've ever read the book, you may remember this scene at the very end where there are these dwarves who've rejected Aslan. And they walk around, and though the children and everyone else are kind of in this paradise place where they're eating luxurious foods and enjoying one another's company, there's this group of dwarves that go around complaining, it's so stingy in here. It stinks in here. And they reach down for some of the children, offer them some of the wine and some of the meat, and they go to have a bite, and they spit it out and like, ah, why did you just give us these feces? And they're experiencing the same reality, but their hearts are hard, their eyes are spiritually blind, and they just experience reality. It's a very interesting concept. Speaking of C.S. Lewis, if these things interest you, C.S. Lewis tries to merge these two ideas of place and state of being together in his book, The Great Divorce. If you want to know, if you want a very readable, very challenging, but very practical book on this whole subject, his book, The Great Divorce, and it goes like this. There's this group of people in hell who decide to take a day trip to heaven. They hop on the bus. The bus kind of takes them from hell up to heaven. And they get around and visit the place, and they interview a few people. What is it like here? How's the weather? You know. And in the end, they decide they don't like it very much and get back on the bus and head back to hell because they find that preferable. The idea is this. Whatever we think about as hell or heaven, or maybe we don't even think at all, the Christian idea is this. If you were to take somebody, let's say in eternity, 10,000 years into eternity, and kind of take them out of this place or this state of being or whatever you imagine it, called hell, and you're going to say, hey, would you like to go to heaven? I don't know. What's it like there? Well, Jesus is king, and there everybody loves God with all of their hearts, and they love their neighbor as themselves, and they prefer others in place of themselves. That person would say, no, I'm not interested in living in a place like that, and that they would choose to go back. The Bible says Jesus was on the cross, not only paid our penalty, but he did so in such a way that it brings real change to our lives, that we become the sort of people who love God and who love our neighbor. Let's go to the next one. Jesus says, calls out with a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Go ahead, William. Let's look at that word hands. Two questions we received were this. When Jesus died, he said, I'm going into my Father's hands. Two questions we received were this. What about those who die young? That was the first question. The idea being that, hey, if there is just a child, like, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and they die tragically, will they get up to heaven and be like, will they be a bit angry? This is what one woman asked and said, you know, if a child dies young, will they feel bad that they didn't get to experience life? you know, that they're in heaven and thought, huh, I didn't get to live a full life on earth. And the biblical answer is no, not at all. No child of God ever died and regretted it. No one's up there thinking, oh, I really wish I was back on earth where I had council tax to pay. And, you know, no child ever died, went to heaven to be with Jesus and into the hands of their father and will look back and think, oh, man, I missed out on puberty. That would have been awesome. You know, it just never happened. What Christians believe and what Jesus taught is that life, it only gets better. It only gets better when you go into the hands of your Father. The good things become better, the bad things fade away, and the best is yet to come. And that anyone is in the presence of Christ does not look back and regret it. The second question is connected. Will we still know people from earth? There's one lady here who lost a loved one, and she said, oh, you know, when I get to heaven or in the new world with the resurrection, will we get these sort of new bodies, and will we even recognize one another? Will I know them? And the answer we get from 1 Corinthians, where Paul is writing on this subject, he says, you know, in this world, we know through a glass darkly. It's like we're looking through this foggy glass at reality and at one another. He said, but one day we will know fully, and we will be fully known. It's not that you won't really know your loved ones in the life to come. It's that when you meet them in the life to come, you'll think you barely ever knew them here. You will meet people on the other side with your new mind and your new body, and you will sit down, and after 5 minutes of talking with them, you might look at your spouse, your best friend, someone you knew here for 30, 40, 50 years. 5 minutes into the next life, you will know them far better. And you will look back and think, man, I barely knew you back then. My vision, my understanding was so clouded by sin and selfishness and pride. But now I see you for who you are. And now you actually see me for who you are. The Bible uses the term, we will be naked and not ashamed. And we will know each other so much better than we ever did in this life. And lastly, Jesus says, Father, into your hands, I entrust my spirit. The last word I want to look at is I entrust. Hey, that's two words. No, in Greek, it's just one word. It's like the Latin verbs. You know, you can tell it's a personal pronoun there. It's I entrust. Father, into your hands, I entrust my spirit. When Jesus dies, he doesn't have this vague, well, I'm stepping into eternity. Maybe there's something there. Whoever he, she, or it is, maybe. No, he knew his Father and he entrusted his life. Right now, your life is entrusted to something. We all entrust our, we entrust it to a relationship, we entrust it to our career, we entrust it to our academic prowess, we entrust it to God. We entrust it to our own savoir faire, we entrust it to our money, to our retirement account. There's something that you're putting your ultimate trust in. I do it, you do it, everybody does. The question is only, what are we entrusting ourselves to? Jesus, he entrusted himself to his Father. When Christians talk about belief in God, it's not just an intellectual sense, like, do you believe he exists? When Christians say, hey, I'm a believer, they don't mean just intellectually, I believe there's something out there somewhere. It's belief in the sense that, not that I believe that chair is there, but I trust that chair enough and I'm going to sit on it. It's this sort of active belief. I'm going to entrust myself to this thing. That's what it means to become a Christian. I became a Christian when I was a teenager, and someone challenged me with a question, a lot like we're talking today. They just asked me this question. They said, hey, if you were to die and stand before God, and you were to ask, like, why would I want to spend eternity with you, what would you respond to him? And I was just I was like, I have no freaking idea. But instead of just calling him an idiot and moving around, the question kind of stuck in my head and it bothered me. And I said, I don't know what's out there, but if anything's out there, I want to find out. So as a teenager, I just picked up the New Testament, began reading the Gospels, and was really gripped by the life of this person called Jesus. And I remember one night as I was reading, I just, in a strange way, and for if you're not a believer, well, this might sound strange to you, but all of a sudden I just felt the presence of God in the room with me. And I had this little question buzzing around in my head, and it was simply, do you think I can do a better job with your life than you can do? And eventually I kind of got down on the side of my bed, and I became a Christian all by myself. I didn't have any priest or pastor, anybody like that in the room, not my parents, nobody. I said, okay, God, I entrust my life to you. I think you can do a better job with my life than I can. And that's a brief story of how I became a Christian. But that's what it means. You're entrusting your life to something or someone right now. When Stephen, there's a guy in the Bible named Stephen in the book of Acts. It was about 10 years or so after Jesus had died and rose again. And it's this record of the early church. And there was this church leader, young man by the name of Stephen. And he got in trouble with the authorities, and he was being stoned to death. And his last words when he died were, Jesus, receive my spirit. He was able to face death with confidence because by life he belonged to Jesus. And he knew then when he died, he would go to be with Jesus.